You're listening to the Agony Column News Report, featuring interviews, phone interviews, reports from live book events and festivals, and conversations with readers. You can find additional news, interviews, book reviews, and more 5 days a week at the Agony Column website at trashotron.com/agony. Alan Chews is the book critic for NPR's All Things Considered. He's a writer and a novelist. His newest work of nonfiction is a collection of travel essays titled A Trance After Breakfast. His newest novel is A Song of Slaves in the Desert. Thank you for joining me, Alan.
A great pleasure, Rick.
We have a variety of works on display today. Let's start with a couple of short story collections from a really interesting new publisher. Tell us a little bit about the publisher.
Well, I can't tell you anything about them except that their name is Cheng and Sui, well, C-S-U-I, and they're in Boston, supposedly, and they've started something they're calling the Contemporary Asian Literature Series, and I think we have what are the first two volumes in it. Digital Geishas and Talking Frogs, which is edited by Helen Mitsios, with a foreword by Pico Iyer. And The Lotus Singer, short stories from contemporary South Asia.
These are really interesting collections. I really enjoyed going through them. You're not going to like absolutely everything in them, but I think as I read through the stories, I just found myself going, some of them are just really jaw-droppingly, yeah. And they all have a great kind of, this is very different from what you're going to get anywhere else.
Yeah, the Japanese stories, they had a couple of names that I recognized, as in mainly Murakami.
Sure, and with a great story that it doesn't get better.
No, the talking frog that tries to save Japan from the giant worm. And he calls on what is clearly a madman to help him.
Super Frog saves Tokyo.
Right, so I recognize that. That story, I'd read it when it came out in his collection a couple of years ago, but I really didn't know any of these other writers. And some of the stories, as you say, were quite striking. They range from, I guess you'd call photographic realism, as in the story called Ikebukuro Westgate Park by Ira Ishida, which is kind of gives you slackers and addicts and layabouts in this louche district in Tokyo, which includes very interesting little details like the sex cafe where you go and sit in a booth in the middle of the cafe and have sex with your girlfriend.
Very anime kind of feel to that story, I thought. I really liked the way it had that kind of, for a piece of photographic realism, it was super lively and exciting. The seeing that culture so vividly.
Right, and
portrayed.
It was kind of an eye-opener. And it brought me back to something, an historian friend of mine who's worked in and with Japanese material for a long time said, he pointed out to me, the Japanese are different from us. They had no romantic period. So, sex does not necessarily mean wonderful metaphors and vows of loyalty and fealty. It just means going at it.
Well, that's true. And, there's, I really liked, too, The Diary of a Mummy.
Yes, that's the story I was going to mention.
That is really creepy.
Yes, this
creepy
report from this diary that a hiker finds about a man who starves himself to death and takes an awful long time, goes on for a couple of months. You didn't know anybody could go that long without food. That is really bizarre. I can think of nothing in American fiction. Maybe Poe comes close, maybe Ambrose Bierce comes close, but maybe... No, I think this is almost a one-of-a-kind story, really striking.
Right.
So you go, those are the extremes, but in the middle are some really wonderful stories about family life, about, the life of a woman, the life of, what it's like to be the daughter of a famous writer, kids, all sorts of interesting tales about domestic life in Japan that that we get from writers we've never heard of. And it really shows you how America must be a very bizarre country to most people who read the literature in translation, because the translations, the body of the translations are so narrow. Mm-hmm. I mean, look at this Japan as opposed to the Japan you'd know through the major commercial translations. It's a different country.
It is.
Deeper and more interesting.
Way more interesting, and a great book to read that'll really, I think, keep you captivated. It's well worth your valuable reading time.
Yeah, and The Lotus Singers does the same thing for South Asia. I think there are about stories here from about 8 countries in 7 or 8 different languages: English, Gujarati, Marathi, Urdu, Bengali. And the writers, again, are mostly
people
unknown
never...
to me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the Pakistani writer Hassan Manzar writes about an Indian woman assaulted by a ticket collector, a conductor on a train. Who could have predicted that?
It's really it strikes me that the writing is really high quality. I think the translations are good. You don't really think about that. That's one of the things I think both of these anthologies is the presentation and all the kind of extraneous stuff gets out of your way, and it really puts you into these different cultures.
Yeah,
and it's
we have a large collection of stories with translations by a number of hands. I mean, you're bound to get a bumpy phrase or two, which I think you do here. But overall, I think it's quite a good quality of translation. And the stories are so various and so interesting. I mean, they're just bloody interesting.
Mm-hmm.
The life of a young policeman, the life of a wife who's trying to gain some kind of emotional, if not political, freedom. Untouchables who are under the thumb of the local boss in their small town.
The traveling widows.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's such a... I think what these offer, these two collections offer in many ways, is the fictional equivalent of travel writing.
Yeah.
And I think actually better. It's more powerful because they bring an emotional punch to it and a real closeness and more variety. I mean, these writers go places that you're not going to be traveling.
Well, but it's not like picture postcard travel. It's more like a police report and psychiatric report travel, because these are real people with real problems living in really troubling situations, and that's the way most of the people live in this part of the world, maybe in all the world. But it's really worth picking up. I mean, you can read about corruption on in the Maldives Islands and segregation of women in Bangladesh. I mean, it's just so various.
And it's interesting too how much a part class plays in both of these.
Oh, class and caste, absolutely. Yeah,
and that's something that we're actually conditioned to not think about here in America.
Right.
But in the rest of the world, it's a big deal.
Yeah.
And it's interesting to see it here. And again, the effect that you have as you read these things, as you look around yourself and say, boy, how strange we must seem to them, and how strange we must actually be.
And
that's what good books are supposed to do, is
that's right.
Make your own life seem as weird as it really probably is.
Travel to strange places, that's for sure.
And speaking of travels, one of the world's and history's most famous travelers was a 20-year-old man who wrote some pretty fantastic poetry in his time, made a name for himself.
A bad boy.
He was a bad boy.
Poet maudit. How would we translate that? A mischievous poet.
Mischievous. they'd probably call him a bomb-throwing anarchist these days and want to try to... pull down his internet blog.
About as the closest character I think maybe we have in our literature to Arthur Rimbaud is, Holden Caulfield, maybe?
Close, yeah, but he's more, I think, I don't think we have anybody like Rambo.
No, a 14-year-old genius who speaks the language in a way that no one else has spoken it before on the page.
And sees the world in a way that nobody has seen it before.
And revolutionizes French poetry in the overturns the canon. But you invite him to your house, he pisses on your dining room table and steals your silverware.
Not necessarily the best house guests, but pretty interesting, damn interesting to read about. And I think that the author Bruce Duffy has done a good job in this, you know, the treacherous world of fictional biography. It's a dangerous line to tread, and I think he does a pretty darn good job of bringing us the feel of Rambo's life. And this book has an interesting structure, I think, going mm-hmm. back and forth between his days of wild poetry and his final swan song when he was, you know, still essentially a young man, but walking around and living the life of an ancient old man ready to give
up
the ghost.
Yeah, well, you know, his legend was that he was a child prodigy and then went to Paris and overturned the life of Paul Verlaine, the poet, had an affair with Verlaine.
Scandalized the world.
Kind of made a menage in the Verlaine household. And he published a lot of his great poems. I mean, they're great poems. And then he left for Africa, left for North Africa, and stopped writing poetry completely, became a gun runner, an entrepreneur, until his mid-30s when he came home to die.
And what's so interesting, you know, as a figure in the world of arts, he really stands a lot of people, you know, Patti Smith is one of his big fans.
Mm-hmm.
And you can see why, because he had, you know, took his passion from the world of arts into the real world to try to do something. But what's so interesting is how tragic that seems to us in the aftermath.
Well, Duffy's novel doesn't make him out to be a tragic figure. I mean, not even a pathetic figure. I mean, he seems to do what he wants to do.
Mm-hmm.
He's kind of like a gremlin genius or an imp of the like Poe's imp of the perverse. I mean, he just appears, a fatherless boy. His father was in the Foreign Legion and abandoned the family basically for foreign adventure, and the mother was a provincial peasant woman who couldn't handle this kid, and he hitchhiked to Paris and overturned Verlaine's life, overturned the world of poetry in France, and has made his mark on the rest of the world. I mean, he's more Christ-like in that regard. Christ who comes, steals your silverware and pisses on your tablecloth and gooses your daughters. But, you know, the kind of poetry, you mentioned Patti Smith, but he's an influence on Wallace Stevens. You can mm-hmm. hear that. I mean, that same kind of ethereal lyric music in Stevens.
Now, one of the things I think that Duffy does well is to, you know, provide us with a plot structure for an unplotted life. I mean, although to a degree, Rambo's life really did have a nice structure to at least write about.
Well, you know, the way Duffy presents it, it's really kind of interesting. I mean, he does take a stance, and you see the child growing into the prodigy, and you go back and forth to the mother throughout the course of the novel, and eventually he comes home and dies in the mother's arms. So it's almost as though he's too brilliant to have been born, and he finally dies very young in the arms of his mother, as the only way he could live was to die, go home and get unborn again.
That's an interesting perception. I think that to my mind, I think Duffy probably could have trimmed a few parts of this. I think, you know, his life was you know, short. And I think it might have, to my mind, the book could have used, you know, some trimming out of some mm-hmm. of the parts.
You know, Duffy's an odd duck as a novelist. You know, he wrote this huge novel, based on the life of Wittgenstein. Mm-hmm. And now here he is doing Rambo. He takes about 140 years to do these books each.
It was 1987 for the Wittgenstein. So, yeah, that's a...
Well, I think he had a novel in between that went... And it didn't go anywhere, I think. So he's really just one of a kind writer. I guess we could try to imagine whom he'll choose next, but I don't know. Who would that be?
Steve Jobs. And by the time it comes out, we'll be living in a very peculiar future. That will be created by some of the events you can read about in Triple Crossing, Sebastian Rotel.
Yeah, I found this novel a really terrific first novel. He's a journalist by trade who's written a couple of books about the Mexican border. And this Triple Crossing is set on the Mexican border and down at the famous Triple Crossing where Argentina, Uruguay, and Paraguay meet. No, Argentina, Brazil, and Paraguay meet, which is kind of the smuggler's choice to cross over from, bring goods in from various parts of Europe into the Americas. The main character is a border patrolman who's working for a dirty supervisor, and he is almost immediately, as the novel begins, he's almost immediately... corralled by an investigator, a very lovely woman named Puente, Isabel Puente. She's an American, a Puerto Rican American agent, and she gets him to go undercover for her in her investigation of corruption in the Border Patrol and among the Mexican authorities on that side of the border. And he falls for her, she falls for him. Temperature of the novel goes way up, and at the same time, he's got to survive. As part of this, what's the word I want? Quadrilla. You know. He's got to survive as part of this quadrilla of young killers whom the Mexican smugglers are employing.
One of the things that he does really well is to get us into the minds of somebody who's working in an undercover role. The conflicts, the danger, and to use that to ratchet up the tension, to create a character who's becoming, we see somebody becoming more complex before our very eyes by virtue of the lives they're living.
Yeah, that's an interesting point.
And I think that that's a really great kind of means of both plotting a novel and plotting a novel by making the characterization a part of your plot.
In an odd way, I found, I mean, Rotel is a good novelist. He knows how to make an exciting scene. He knows how to pace it and such. I found that the characters who were further away from Rotella were more interesting than Rotella himself. The Mexican investigator, the Mexican dirty cops.
Well, that's such a great world that we don't know much about. I think that there's one of the things that this novel does really well, too, is to put us in this world and give us a lot of great information. I mean, you know, it's like a kind of slightly glossed over news report that where he can say what he really, really feels about these people without worrying about.
Yeah, it's kind of the way David Ignatius does, you know, his international politics reporting in his novels.
Yeah, that's an interesting way to put it.
He can be truthful in the novel about Pakistan in ways that he doesn't dare in his news reports.
And that's I think, what you get here, and that's what makes it these things so compelling and really, I mean, it's a good, it's a really gripping novel.
Triple Crossing by Sebastian Rotella.
And Michael Harvey's We All Fall Down, taking the Chicago noir mystery straight into the 21st century, I think, in a very interesting.
You know, it's an odd book. It's a kind of a mix of crime thriller and echo thriller.
Yeah, I think, and he does a good job of setting up both, giving you both aspects of this and bringing them together in a convincing way. And there's also a lot of great stuff in here that's new and
The PI, who's the main character,
Michael Kelly.
you know, has to learn a lot about what we call, we learn to call after reading the novel, black biology, which is what the bad guys are indulging in. They want to make a virus that'll kill all of us. And then against that is this field called bioinformatics, which the good guys, in which the good guys are working to build viruses to counter the viruses they think the bad guys are going to build to use against us. And that's all there. I love one of the scientists with guns who walk through this novel, these biologists who are doing the research in bioinformatics, says to Kelly when they've pulled him in to investigate this anthrax release in the subway system of Chicago. She says, "Now don't pull any Jack Bauer heroics," she says, "but Kelly, he is Jack Bauer-like in that he does things that most normal people would not do. And is he cool? He's so cool. I mean, it's one thing to stand there and not comment when the corrupt mayor of Chicago is telling you what to do, but he takes it very coolly when there's a 14-year-old gangbanger who has a gun to his head and is about to shoot him while they're already... The rest of the gang is digging his grave in the basement of this drug stash in the basement of a store in one of the forbidden zones of Chicago, and Kelly just waits this guy out, and he survives, but I won't tell you how.
One of the things I think that is nice about this book that, given the kind of slightly science fictional aspect of the bio warfare. It's not, I guess it's not really science fictional, but it feels that way because we haven't really had that on the scale that we see here yet. That he and the kind of terrorism backdrop, that what unfolds is I think really interesting and surprising, and he does a good job of, you know, kind of misdirecting you.
Right. It's a neat plot.
Yeah, I thought the plot is really nicely orchestrated in this book.
Yeah.
And it certainly has a lot of, I mean, there's a lot of really kind of shocking surprises.
Right. You got these scientists with guns, you got clean scientists, you got dirty scientists, you got a filthy ex-CIA agent running around Chicago, and Kelly, who just stands up against all these people, and that, you know, the mayor asked him to take care of this, and he does.
And
I said, cool.
Yeah, with a great update of the, you know, a classic kind of PI, Chandler-esque in some ways.
Yeah.
Just taken right into a world that Chandler himself could just never have imagined.
Right.
And I think that's cool. He's cool. And that's cool, and I'm looking forward to the next one. I'm ready to go. And I've been speaking with Alan Shoes. He's the critic for NPR's All Things Considered. His newest novel is Song of Slaves in the Desert. Thank you for joining me, Alan.
Great pleasure again, Rick.
You're listening to the Agony Column News Report, featuring interviews, phone interviews, reports from live book events and festivals, and conversations with readers. You can find additional news, interviews, book reviews, and more 5 days a week at the Agony Column website at trashotron.com/agony.